What do you believe? What do you say about what you believe? And why exactly does it matter? Learn more about the what and why of the Christian creeds and Lutheran confessions this month in the Lutheran Witness. Get 6 issues of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's premier magazine for only $6.99 when you visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/trylutheranwitness.
New York Times recently ran a column by Aaron Carroll titled "Sex Education Based on Abstinence? There's a Real Absence of Evidence." It says, in effect, that broad spectrum sex education is successful. Abstinence sex education, not so much. Can't find any real reason why we should continue it, much less withdraw funding from broad spectrum sex education. We're going to be talking about that New York Times column on this Wednesday afternoon, August the 30th. Joining us to do so, Dr. Ryan McPherson. He has a PhD in history and philosophy of science from Notre Dame. He's a professor of history at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota, and he's author of the book, The Culture of Life, 10 Essential Principles for Christian Bioethics. Dr. McPherson, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be here.
Let's deal with the first objection that the New York Times column raises there, and that is that abstinence-based sex education is simply impractical. You can't expect anyone to abstain, much less teenagers.
Yes, there are several problems with that argument. One is that we don't take that same attitude to other issues that we try to prevent. Let's take an example close to the school system, since that's where the context is for sex ed. Students cheat. Students plagiarize. Do we say it's not practical to expect them never to cheat or to plagiarize? Should we have courses that teach them how to cheat safely, how to plagiarize and get away with it? Perhaps that would prepare them for a career in politics, but for nothing else, it's good. And so surely when it comes to things like that, we say no cheating, no plagiarizing. We have standards there. And the same should be all the more true when we're talking about sexual behaviors that put everyone involved at risk, not just short-term, but long-term, not just physically, but emotionally, and of course, spiritually as well.
Then the second objection that is raised there really has to do with probably something that goes more deeply than mere opinion that this is a useless enterprise. It has to do with the evidence, and it claims, the New York Times piece, that the evidence isn't there that abstinence-only education affects outcomes. First of all, what outcomes are expected here, and is that statement true?
The statement is, at best, half true. It's highly misleading. You asked about outcomes, and that's certainly part of the story. So we have to have a definition of good results. You know, what would it take to prove that some educational method is helpful? What do we mean by helpful? And part of the problem is that our society has basically made a god out of avoiding teen pregnancy and avoiding STDs. They've elevated that to the height, and then they're willing to sacrifice other things in order to achieve that end. And for one thing, we should keep in mind there's nothing wrong with teen pregnancy. A married teen, for example, could become pregnant, and we would consider that a blessing. So even the verbiage that they use is rather confusing. But the problem is that we're seeing, yes, a fall in teen pregnancy over the past 25 years. The rate has dropped roughly in half. But we're also seeing a rise in abortifacient birth control that's being used by teens. And so have we really accomplished anything beneficial in that transition? I would argue, no, we've not. And if anything, we've put these sins underground where they're no longer dealt with, where we can no longer have healing and reconciliation because we hide them under this rubric of safe sex. Some of the other measures that they use would be the increase of condom use is considered a measure of success. The decrease of the number of partners is considered a measure of success. And the delay of the first sexual experience is a measure of success. With the last two, I tend to agree. With the first one, an increase in condom use, again, I think you're just cloaking the problem rather than dealing with it. And what we find in these studies of comprehensive sex ed that supposedly are successful, the strongest metric that they have to demonstrate success is, in fact, the increase in condom use, that they'll increase it by 60%.
I think I have to ask the kind of the practical question here, and that is, we're dealing with a population that is probably not going to be entirely honest when you seek data from them on these various practices, in particular condom use. A lot of the things that we're trying to measure here happen in the proverbial backseat of the car. How reliable is anyone's data on the outcomes?
I don't think they're reliable at all, and you've hit the nail on the head. There's a serious methodological flaw in these studies, and there's also a catch-22. And so from a scientific standpoint, the researchers are really in a bind. They either have to generate unreliable data, or if they want their data to be reliable, they have to violate basic research ethics. One of the principles that our own Department of Health and Human Services has is this idea of informed consent. And especially for minors who are considered vulnerable human subjects research, informed consent by their parents is required, especially when we're dealing with sensitive issues such as asking students about their sexual habits. And so the question is that always gathered? Well, what you find is that there are ways to try to circumvent that. For example, rather than having parents opt in, they have the parents opt out, which means if parents fail to sign a form, by default, the student participates. But what we also find is that there's a large attrition rate. And so what they'll do is they'll do one survey, and then they'll teach a course, and then they'll do a post-test survey afterwards and compare the results. And they do this with lots of different curricula to try to figure out which curricula tend to change the students' behaviors. The problem is that the students, after they've been surveyed once, often are not willing to be surveyed a second time. And I think this is even more likely for students who are being raised in homes that promote chastity. Why would you want to subject yourself to this sort of questionnaire a second time? So on the studies that were trying to test the abstinence-only programs, there's a tendency for as many as half of the participants to not fill out the second survey. And so then the data is unreliable. Meanwhile, especially on the comprehensive programs, there's a move to have peer instruction. In other words, students are instructing fellow students in sex ed, and students are giving surveys or interviews to fellow students afterwards. And the answers that a student gives to a peer tend to be markedly different than the answers that a student gives to an adult, which comes back to your initial question there about how reliable are these. They tend to affirm a greater amount of promiscuity when talking to a peer versus to cover it up, or maybe it was just a story that was made up when talking to the peer. Maybe they're being more honest with the adult, but at any rate, they report less promiscuity to adults on average.
Are any of these outcomes preventing, or these measures that are being used in the studies that have been done of both abstinence-based and comprehensive sex education, in and of themselves, bad outcomes to hope for, in your opinion?
Well, the increased use of condoms, I think, is a bad outcome because it's not dealing with the root problem. You know, if we view that as a success, then, okay, fine. There's a lower likelihood of getting pregnant. There's a lower likelihood of transmitting a sexually transmitted disease, although neither of those is eliminated to zero. But we might call that a success. But then I ask this question. Where's the longitudinal data? Where are the longitudinal studies that ask, how are those teens doing 20 years later when they're in their 30s, when they're trying to be settled into stable marriages and raise children of their own? Are they haunted by guilt because of decisions that they were pushed into through a sex ed propaganda course that trained them on condom use? Where are the longitudinal studies that look at their emotional well-being, not to mention even their spiritual well-being, later in life? Do we really want to call that a success?
It is often said that abstinence works when it's tried, you know, every single time. There is something qualitatively different about an abstinence approach and a comprehensive approach, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And the comprehensive approach, it sounds good, comprehensive. Why do we want to leave anything out? And in fact, don't students have a right to this information? Those are the slogans that you'll hear. What it does is it celebrates all manner of experimentation. It suggests that sex is just a plaything, that you can just try it out and find out what you like, and that's good for you, and do your thing. What it forgets about is what it means to take care of oneself, what it means to be caring for someone else, what it means to be protective of people who are close to you, and what it means to treasure something that is a special gift, to treasure it enough in order to wait for it, to celebrate it with just the right person, and only that person for the rest of your life. And so an abstinence program will tend to extol the virtues of marriage, and will set that goal out there as something worthy of patience.
Do you share a deeper concern expressed by other guests on this program about what's called comprehensive sex education, in that its very premise is untested on our youth? And that premise being that we are essentially sexual beings, that this is something that needs to be cultivated and expressed from the earliest possible age, a skewing of kind of the anthropology of our youth.
Yes, I do. And the transition we're talking about here, you can trace it in the history of the word sex itself. I mean, for the long term, the word sex has simply meant being either male or female. But then sex came to refer to an act, initially an act that is potentially procreative, the marital act, but then also to other acts in all manner of experimentation. And then from an act to an identity, so that people can speak of having a sexual orientation or identifying as a transgender person. And the formation of that identity is really an act of fiat, of self-will, this idea, let me be whatever. And it comes out of, a couple of movements. One very ancient, the other is more recent. The ancient one is this heresy that the early church had to wrestle with called Gnosticism. Gnosticism has a sharp distinction between the body and the soul, and it says that the body is either bad or else at best kind of irrelevant, and that the soul is what really matters. And so we get this idea of being soulmates regardless of what our bodies are, which justifies things such as homosexuality. The bodies might not fit together the same way, but it doesn't matter because it's the feeling that matters. All of that language is essentially Gnostic. And then more recently, another philosophical movement of the past 50 or so years is existentialism. So coming back to the heart of your question, existentialism says that my identity is whatever I choose it to be. There is no human nature that dates back to creation and that remains rather permanent and fixed. Rather, I get to reinvent human nature through the action of my own will, through the choices of my own actions. And so I can wake up one day and say, now I identify as whatever sort of sexual identity I want to say to fill in the blank, and everyone else around me ought to respect and validate that. That's the culture that we're in now, and it's largely the result of a revival of Gnosticism and this movement known as existentialism, which used to just be a radical philosophy among university professors. But now I would suggest to you it is the philosophy that you see in social media at the grassroots level across America now.
Dr. Ryan McPherson is a PhD in history and philosophy of science from Notre Dame. He's professor of history at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota, author of the book, The Culture of Life, 10 Essential Principles for Christian Bioethics. You'll find a link to his website at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. McPherson, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Anna Mussman, a stay-at-home mother of two toddlers. We're going to talk about something she used to do when she was a teenager, Civil War reenactments. And, of course, many have been canceled in the wake of the war on what? The white supremacy of the past? The racism of the past? Is that a good idea? We'll answer that question after this.
Do you wish your Lutheran school offered Latin, Greek, or logic? What about German or calculus? Right now, local Lutheran schools in two different states are utilizing Wittenberg Academy to expand their course offerings. Whether it's Latin for third graders or logic for seniors in high school, Wittenberg Academy can help. For your homeschooler or for your brick-and-mortar Lutheran school, we have solutions. To find out more, visit wittenbergacademy.org.
The Law Assumed Sermon, the Gospel Afterthought Sermon, the God Loves You Anyway Sermon. I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled An Updated Listener's Guide to the Pulpit. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Dr. Matt Richard details his journey from folk Lutheranism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not only does our church need men right now, but the world needs men who will proclaim the gospel in its purity.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Peter Scare, Associate Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
If when you go to sleep at night, you're thinking about it, my experience with it is this, is that thought won't go away. So if you're going to bed at night thinking about following our Lord and becoming a preacher of this gospel, then I would love if you could come and visit Fort Wayne, our campus. We'd love to show you around and show you what it is that we do.
Have you ever considered becoming a pastor? Contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.